Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Open Mic Comedy Podcast. I'm your host, Mark. If this is your first time here, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. This podcast is here for people on the open mic comedy circuit, whether you're a comedian, an MC, a promoter, a tutor, in fact, anybody who has any involvement in this industry. Even comedy fans who really do enjoy spending their time in pub basements watching the stars of the future. And if you're thinking, I could do that, then this podcast will give you the inside track on what to expect on this crazy circuit. Today's guest is someone who has seen the open mic comedy circuit pre and post the pandemic. He likes the idea of being a sailor, a self-confessed fan of Pokemon Go, and if you're sensitive to lavender, then no need to swipe right. It's my pleasure to welcome to the stage Mr. Matt Lowes.
Hey, Mark. What a lovely Hello. Invite. That's great. I like that. Good.
Can you tell I've recently watched your blackout video? And I implore anybody that hasn't seen it, we'll put a link in the description. Go and watch it. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. I love the start of it, where it starts off really kind of... It starts off a little bit slow, and then it just sort of goes, yeah. As soon as you say the word, the last part of the three, I think that's the bit you go, yeah, yeah, I like that bit. That's cool.
I think I've realised that's the only gong show that I've got through.
Yeah.
And I think the only way to do it is to call people in the audience homophobes. I found that really works.
That's the formula.
That is the formula, yeah. Scare them into giving you a card. So basically what happened was there was a group of sort of property maintenance people, like on a work outing. There was about 30 of them to the left of the stage. And as soon as the first opportunity was given, a card went up from that side.
Oh.
And I just went, you're a fucking homophobe, which is risky. And the rest of the audience went crazy for it. And I think they were just scared to put cards up. So, yeah. That's how you get through.
No, it was so funny watching it. I was just like, okay, this is going to be fun. I'm going to enjoy this one. So you mentioned to me that you started comedy pre-pandemic. So yes. So tell us from the start then. Why did you decide to try this?
To be honest, I think I've always wanted to do it. Like, I'm not. I hear sort of people's comedy origin stories that are like, yeah, I just stumbled and fell on the stage and got up and started talking, and it turns out I'm really good at it. Tell you what, it's been a life ambition to be this mediocre. I've worked very hard to be this mediocre. I wanted to since I was a kid.
Yeah.
I remember, I think in primary school, doing like a talent show, and I decided to do comedy. I can't remember any of the jokes, and I probably wouldn't repeat them if I did, because they were probably rubbish. But even like when you choose your options at like year nine or something like that. My parents were like, what do you want to do? I was like, I want to be a comedian. They were like, oh, okay. Do you want to do drama? I was like, no way. No, because I was a very sort of quiet, shy child and young adult. And then I think the first sort of real point of wanting to do comedy was I did a best man speech.
Okay,
For my best friend that I'd known since school year two. So I think you're like, I don't know, six or seven then or something like that. Mm. And I was like, well, I'm not going to get an opportunity like this again for someone I've known for so long.
Yeah.
I was like, I better make it good. So, yeah, I wrote out this speech. And then like one of the bride's uncles came up to me afterwards and was like, have you ever thought of doing stand-up comedy? And I was like, who, me? No.
Never.
And then, a few years after that, It's obviously still playing in my mind. And then I got drunk one night and I got one of those Instagram or Facebook ads that was like, Angel Comedy, do a comedy course. So I signed up to that when I was drunk. And then the next morning I was like, oh, yeah, I did do that. I did sign up. I did just pay £250-300. So, yeah, January 2019 was when I started the Angel course. And, yeah, the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah. How did you find doing the course?
Yeah, I loved it. So I did the Angel course with Francis Foster, who used to be a teacher. I think he taught at the same school or taught with Romesh in Crawley.
Oh, okay.
So he knew, obviously, I always think that, you know, he could have someone really great at doing comedy, but whether they would be able to impart that knowledge, whereas he was like, I can teach as well. I know what I'm doing. I'm a comedian, but also I can teach this sort of stuff. It was really good. And it was all about sort of building up your 5 minutes. To be honest, the first day of the course, we did improv. I'd never done anything performance before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we did the, I love improv, so I'm not shitting on improv.
Yeah.
But when we were doing like, I'm a tree, that sort of thing, I was like, this is not for me. I don't know what I've done signing up to do this. And then the second sort of half of that, day was, you had to go up and tell a story for 2 minutes on stage or whatever. And I did that and people laughed and I was like, oh, this is a good feeling. I like this.
Yeah.
And then you have a showcase at the end, which probably, definitely one of the, definitely the most terrifying thing I've ever done. Scarier than parachuting, I would say. I was more worried about dying on stage than actually dying. And then I just started doing gigs.
Yeah.
It's great. To start off with, I've got to be honest, I was just getting used to being on stage.
Yeah.
So I would do the same 5 minutes for 60 or 70 gigs, like, until the pandemic kicked in. I mean, I would change it. Like, I would try new stuff. GMB was sort of my playground, as it were, for trying out new stuff. But everywhere else, I was just getting used to being up on stage. It wasn't what I had done before. You know, like I say, I was quite a shy, timid child who had never done any performance per se before. So, yeah. And then obviously what I would say about that is you get bored of saying the same old stuff and it turns like robotic in the end. So.
I think it's important to get that first five nailed down, but it's also you need to be able to implement some fun parts to it. So you need to be able to change bits and pieces, but not change anything fundamental. But you're going to have to say something in a slightly different way and try and work out if that reaction is something better than what you had before. And you're learning. It's one of the only things where you can really learn your craft live.
Yeah.
Just can't do it. You can't do it. You can practice at home, but you don't get that reaction from the cat and the dog that's walking around. So,
no, exactly. And it's
the other
it's
half just heard it so many times, and there's no natural kind of feedback.
Yeah. I mean, it just goes back to what people say about don't be afraid to fail.
Yeah.
I think that's taken me a while to learn. Now I fail all the time, and it's great. Enjoy it sometimes, but
I think when you've tied something down so much, sometimes when you feel like something's not going so well on stage, when you've got the experience, your brain has the ability to do something else rather than be tied to that first five, and your you're banging away at that five going, they'll laugh at the next line. They'll laugh at the next line when the back of your head, you're like, they're not going to enjoy this next bit if they didn't like that. So,
Now I love it. Now I'm like, I want something to happen. I'm like, don't make me do my set. Just something happened in the audience. Something happened in the room that I can react to and riff off that. Now I love that sort of stuff. Yeah.
So how is it different then? Or is it different actually pre and post pandemic in terms of gigs, audiences and stuff like that?
I think, to be honest, for my first year, like, let's just say, January 2019 to January 2020, which was basically, then the pandemic kicked in a couple of months after that. I feel like I was just messing about, and I felt like everyone else was sort of, I had it in my mind, and I can't say whether I was taught this, but I was like, this stuff takes years to do. You know, this is a long process. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. Mm-hmm. Just going to mess about, just going to do some stuff on stage, that sort of thing, get used to being on stage. And then the people that have come in after the pandemic, and I think a lot of people, I don't know, I can't really speak for them, but I think a lot of people, you know, sat at home during the pandemic and thought, what do I really want to do with my life? What do I, you know? And a lot of people went, actually, I want to do stand-up comedy. So there's a massive influx of people, and they took it very seriously, and they were really good. So I'm like, I'm going to have to up my game, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I was sort of in this mind that, this is going to take ages. I'm not going to. And then people come in and start really smashing it, and I'm like, wow, okay, yeah, I need to up it a little bit.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've only been in this for a year, but when I look back at what my preconceptions were of what stand-up comedy on an open mic circuit was, it's going to be okay. But you come away from some rooms in absolute hysterics thinking, why are these people not famous yet?
They're good.
There are some people that just absolutely smashed their life out of these rooms, and you think, if you were Rob Beckett or Ramesh or whoever, people would be falling over you. And you just think, this is the standard on the open mic circuit.
Yeah.
Everyone can get there. It just depends how quickly you want to get there. I think it was said to me from somebody at Backyard was that when you apply for the new act night, you know, new act to me at the time was, first 10 gigs. It's 100 plus is new.
Yeah.
Which is really bizarre to get your head around if you've not been in this and seen this industry. And you realize that, 100 gigs is kind of when you're really finding your feet, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. And I sort of, I was different in that I knew that when I first came into it. I was like, this is going to be a long. And then, like I say, people just came out of the blocks and was like, really good at it. And now sort of, I'm like the old man still here doing it.
Oh, there's plenty of us there. There's still a lot of old men around.
But what I mean is, obviously I'm a fan of the podcast. I've listened to all the episodes.
Thank you.
And it's when the first one, when Chris Alley, who I absolutely love Chris Alley, but he was like, I've been doing it for like a couple of years. I feel like the granddad. And I was like, blimey, that makes me the great granddad. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a very, I guess it's one of those, because there's no age limit on the lower scale and there's no age limit on the upper scale for doing this, because you can just go and do it.
Which is great, because, you get people from all different walks of life.
There is no real, there's no real barrier for this. It's any sex, race, creed, whatever, age, it doesn't matter. You know, even if your jokes are hugely dark, there are nights out there for you. If you're a gay comic, there's loads of gay nights out there for you. There's just something for everybody. And there's an amalgamation of nights which include everybody. So dark, whatever. And it's just, it's quite nice, because you know that when you go to these places, you're not going to see the same thing.
Yeah, it's true. And it's always exciting when you see someone you haven't seen before as well.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, let's see what you come up with. And like I say, they're usually new and it's really good.
Yes.
I'd always love it when there's someone who comes along and goes, oh, it's my first gig. I'm like, I can tell you now, you're going to smash it. I'm really going to hate you afterwards.
Yeah.
You're going to do a lot better than me.
Yeah. On a previous episode, I mentioned about I did an MC gig, and the person that went first, it was their first gig outside of a showcase.
Wow.
And they were 17 years old.
Right.
And I kind of did the daddy thing and said, are you sure you want to go first? And they said, yes, I want to go first. Definitely want to go first. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure this is a good idea. You're setting up the whole night. And then this person just walloped it out of the park and was just like, well, what do we do from that then?
Exactly.
I've just introduced somebody who's 30 years younger than me on the stage. He's kind of just absolutely hoofed it out of the room and set up the night perfectly. And when you see that, you kind of think, the open mic circuit isn't exactly what I imagined it would be.
Yeah.
There's so much talent out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think you really understand the open mic circuit until you're in it.
No. Oh, 100%. So going on to sort of like best and worst moments then on the stage for you.
Let's go with worst first. Let's build up. do you know what? I had one last year, which was one of these, you know, when a comedy night starts around people, you know, there's a group of people that were sort of middle-aged, middle-class who'd gone out for a drinks.
Yeah.
I think it was like two couples gone out for drinks in a pub. And then all of a sudden, there's a comedy night starting around them. And obviously, I opened. And I got up, and obviously I started talking about fucking men. And I mean, at one point, one of the guys, two of them had their back to me because that's the way the tables were lined up. And one of the guys had his head in his hands. Dave wasn't laughing, Mark, so you are. And I remember after, and I was like, I'm so sorry. You're not enjoying this at all. You know, I had to reference it. Yeah. But after my set, they left. They left. And the guy who had his head in his hands tapped me on the shoulder and was like, good effort. I was like, oh, God, this is horrible. This is awful. Let's get over that and go on to best moments. I think, can I have two best moments, please?
You can, as many as you want.
Again, one last year, and I think it was quite close to this other one that went really badly. I turned up to a gig that I'd never done before, realised it was in the corner of a pub, and I was like, oh, God, here we go. It's going to be one of those, you know, corner of the pub gigs. And this is probably a story about how you shouldn't just prejudge a night.
Yeah.
Because it was just when everything happened in the right way. Like, things happened in the room.
Yeah.
You know, the comedy gods were gifting me things. You know, and I was just like playing off them, and it worked really well. And these two girls who were, you know, audience members. Mm-hmm. Not comedians or anything like that, came up to me afterwards and was like, you made me cry. I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And they were like, no, from laughing. I was like, but yeah, boom. That's what you want. That's, you know, if you made someone cry from laughing, fantastic.
Yeah.
And the other one I would say as well is the New Forest New Comedian final.
Okay.
That was last year as well. And it was emceed by Anna Mann, played by Colin Holt,
okay,
who is just one of my favourite acts, one of sort of my comedy heroes. Back in 2019, Colin put up, or maybe it was during the pandemic, Colin put up, that was definitely before the pandemic, sorry, I'm getting confused with myself. Colin put up on the Comedy Collective or whatever, if anyone needs help, like training or whatever, let me know. So I sent him an email and said, look, here's my video, here's what I do, can you help?
Yeah.
And his response was, yes, we can definitely help with that. Good. So that was all going to happen, and then the pandemic kicked in.
Yeah.
And then obviously as time went on, I got to watch the Anna Mann videos and went to see Anna Mann and do her show and things like that. And then on the actual New Forest final, Colin came up to me and was like, oh, well, I recognize you. this is from 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I did send you a video. It's like, he's like, oh yes, you talk about being like bisexual. I was like, oh my God, yeah, he recognizes me and remembers my stuff. And he goes, he actually said, oh, Matt Lowe's as I live and breathe. And I was like, oh, my life is made now. I know he probably said that to make me feel better about myself. But
yeah.
So that was just a fantastic, and it was the first final that I've been in as well. So even meeting Colin Holt, I was like, yeah, I'm quite happy to go home now, actually. I don't need to do my stuff, but my life is made, you know. So
how did you find that competition then? And where did you finish? Did you get a result?
I didn't get a result. I didn't finish in the top three. I was just happy to be in the final. If you don't know the competition, it's David Hardcastle one. So okay. David Hardcastle runs the Leicester Square New Comedian. And I think it was, I don't know if they're doing it again this year. I haven't seen anything. Maybe it's a bit early. But it was kind of like a regional thing. I think David's from around that area.
Okay.
So it was kind of like a regional thing. And the winners from that competition, or the top three, got automatically into, I don't know, over the semi, I think the semi-final, and all the finalists got into the semi-final of the Leicester Square one.
Yeah.
And all the finalists got into the quarter-final as well. So yeah, okay. it was. And like I say, I was just excited because it was the first sort of competition final that I've been into. So
yeah.
Yeah.
So have you done any other competitions?
I've done a lot. Yeah, I did the other final that I've gone to was the West End New Old Act.
Yes.
So there was two finals last year, which I was really pleased about because that just, you know, progress. finally seeing some progress.
Yeah.
But I do enter a lot of the competition, but then I've realised now I'm starting to get a little bit long in the tooth. Like I've been doing it for too long.
Yeah.
The new act competitions, I'm not, you know, like the West End new act of the year this year, I looked at the rules and I was like, yep, I can't do that. So it's like, so that's why I was like, right, what am I going to do now? What's the next step? Where am I going to go? How am I going to progress? So that's why I'm doing my show at the Brighton Fringe. That's where I was like, right, I'm going to take the plunge and do my first solo show. So
cool. So is it the first full hour?
It's going to be a coward's hour, to be honest. It's going to be a 45, which I mean, I don't, it, you know, people say about the coward's hour because I think once you do an hour at Edinburgh, then you're eligible for the awards and things like that. So people just go in with 45 minutes. Don't think it really matters at Brighton.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just going to, but at the moment, probably aiming for 45.
Okay. So what's the details of it all then? What's the show about and called and where is it? And
So the show's called Innuendo.
Okay.
And yeah, it's taken some developments. I mean, I called it Innuendo because I talk, you know, I'm absolute filth, to be honest. But yeah. It sort of, you know, when you start writing the show, you go, oh, okay, I want to start off writing about this and that, and then it develops and goes into. So it's kind of coming into, I guess, my story about sort of being a bit different, coming out,
yeah,
and that sort of thing, you know. So, yeah, I think that's that sort of the that's the aim at the moment. It's still in the writing process at the moment. I took myself for a week away, just like Airbnb, went up to Norfolk.
Yeah.
Because I just get distracted a lot.
Yeah, yeah. When you're at home, what you mean.
You know, I could take a week off at home, but yeah, like you say, you know what I mean. And you're just like, oh, yeah, actually, I might make a cup of tea. Oh, I need to put some washing on. Oh, and before you know it, you haven't done anything. So I was like, yep, right, okay, I'm going to get myself away for a week. And I pretty much put the framework in for the show. So I know where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And now I just need to sort of backfill it with jokes, basically, which you know, which I'm working on. I'm chucking in, and you know, I'm doing, trying out bits and pieces at new material nights and stuff. I did a work in progress at the Queer Comedy Club,
okay,
3 weeks ago, and I think what I took from that, I did 38 minutes up on stage.
Wow,
it was the longest I've ever been up on stage for. So if anything, you know, there were some bits that I go, okay, that didn't work. I need to work on that. You know, yeah, I need to change this stuff, blah, blah, blah. But I think the main thing was going, right, okay, that's how long, you know, that's how long 38 minutes feels. That's how long a show's going to feel being up on stage. So
how did you, with it being a work in progress show, I'm intrigued by this because I've seen a couple of work in progress shows now from professionals, and it's always interesting that how people do them differently. So I've seen like a Ricky Gervais work in progress show, which pretty much turned into what the actual show was.
Right.
So it must have been quite late in the day, but it was very much a how you see him on the Netflix specials with the stand and the beer and walking around and wearing the same clothes and all of that. And then I've seen Jimmy Carr do a work in progress show that was completely different. He literally walked on. I don't know if you've ever seen him do a work in progress show.
No.
He's literally walked on with probably 4 supermarket carrier bags.
Right.
And each one is stuffed full of clipboards.
Okay.
And he will literally just go through telling jokes that he's written down, just the one-liners over and over, different ones. And then what he'll do is he'll mark the joke on that clipboard, whether it was any good or not. And it's interesting to see. It sounds quite dull. Where he's going through, he's going, oh, you know, so-and-so's got cancer, blah, blah, blah. Mm. A little bit of a laugh, that's a 4. But then he may come back to that at a later point and see if it fits in better somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting when he's going through going, no, not that one. I might put that one there with the other one that you kind of liked. And it's like this whole thing of putting together a show as if he's sitting in his front room.
Yeah.
Whereas you get somebody, like I say, with Ricky Gervais, for example, he's putting on a show as a practice. You see what I mean?
Yeah, but I mean, like you say, that's probably the Ricky Gervais one was probably more advanced, wasn't it? And then you don't know what he did on his first work in progress. Maybe it was, you know, something a bit similar, or maybe comes to it with a fully formed idea.
Yeah, I think he does. I think he cheats in his, well, I say cheats in his earlier shows. What he does is I've seen him before with some scribbles on his hand, and that was quite interesting because any open mic comic's probably been there and done that. A few little notes on the hand just to prompt them if something goes wrong. And you're watching Ricky Gervais do it, and I always noticed on that plectrum where he has his beer, there's usually a piece of paper on it. But you can't see it from the angle of the where you are. It got, I saw it on one of the Netflix specials or something. You just see this piece of paper sat there. You kind of like,
okay.
So he's, when he's going over to grab the drink, he's probably having a peek, going, oh yeah, that bit's next.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cheap.
I can't comment. I mean, on my work in progress, I just had the notes in front of me, but I had written it a week before, so I hadn't learned anything. So, yeah. So, yeah, my delivery was off because I was just like, literally, I'll read this bit out, sort of thing. So, but yeah, I know it's interesting you say about the sort of reeling off jokes, because I've seen Mark Simmons do that at TNT. A few times he would sort of headline and he would go there because it would be a new material night for him.
Yep.
So he would go there, and this was 2019 or whatever, with a list of jokes and go, right, I'm just going to read these jokes out and gauge your reaction. And he'll, you know, mark them with a tick, two ticks, or A, B, C. I can't remember how he would do it, but he would be like, okay, that worked. Okay, that didn't work. That sort of thing. So, but he does a podcast as well. Obviously, if you only have time to listen to one podcast, listen to the Open Mic podcast. If you have time to listen to two podcasts, then I recommend his one, because that's where they get jokes with Mark Simmons.
Yeah.
So they get people into, comedians with jokes that don't work, and they try and work them out.
Yes.
And it just gives you everyone an insight, and makes it, you know, it makes me think about sort of jokes and what I would do with the joke, and just, you know, stimulates the creative brain, as it were.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting to see how jokes develop, which kind of neatly segues onto another common question is, it doesn't have to be your best, but your favorite joke, how you came up with it, and how has it changed over time, even if it's just wording shifting around and stuff like that?
So a joke that I've done from the start, from the very start, and that I probably used to rely on for, you know, when I was first 100 gigs or whatever, was I'm bisexual. I think of my sexuality in the way that I think of apples. So I like a pink lady.
Yeah.
I also like cocks. And then the add-on to that became, well, it used to be, but not a Granny Smith.
Yeah.
So that joke has changed very slightly for some quite a lot of reasons. Basically, a one GMB night years ago, I lost the audience because I was like, and not a Granny Smith, because they were... People came up, acts came up afterwards and was like, well, unlike Matt, I do like old people. It made me seem really ageist. And, you know, Kyle gave me some good advice and was like, you lost the audience because, you know, people thought you were ageist. And I was like, okay, no, that's not really my intention. So I've changed it into sometimes a Granny Smith.
Okay.
And also the change that has been made from it is that I started comedy maybe a couple of years after coming out. I thought, because I'd been with women before or whatever, I was bisexual, and then you go, okay, now it's been a few years since and that's not involuntary, so maybe I should be like, I'm gay. But then I was like, oh, I don't know what to do with the joke now, because I really like the, you know, like I was really sort of, that was my early joke to win the audience over.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I don't know, you know, I need to keep saying I'm bisexual because of that joke.
Yeah.
And then I was like, and then it's just so obvious, isn't it? I used to like a pink lady.
Yeah.
And now I like cocks, you know, so yeah, it took me quite a while to work that out. So... And I'm speaking to Mark Cox as well. So, you know.
When I saw that joke in the blackout thing, and I just thought, yeah. Oh, I can't help but just laugh at things like that. I just, yeah. I loved hearing how certain jokes have changed and stuff like that. Because I'm still in this early stage where I'm writing and trying to refine jokes. And I think that's the, when you find that bit where you refine something and it works. I don't know about you, but sometimes in the early days where you're starting to do a joke and like the first 4, 5, 6 times, whatever, it really works well. And then you have a couple of nights where it just doesn't quite work for some reason. Yeah. And you're trying to put your finger on it going, this one usually gets the laugh. And I don't get why it's not getting that laugh. And then you start thinking about how you can swap. If you're doing a rule of three or whatever it is, and how can you swap them around? Because what you think is your strongest might not necessarily be the strongest. So you want to finish on that out of three, ideally.
Yeah. And I mean, for me personally, I'm never consistent as well. Every night is different, even if I'm doing the same set. You know, it's just, it depends on a variety of factors that sometimes you don't even know what that is. Like, did it exactly the same way as I did it the night, like last night, and last night it really killed, and tonight, you know, it's not working. But you know, it is what it is at the end of the day.
Yeah, joke writing is such an interesting thing, because no matter what you think you have, until you've tried that in front of an audience, you'll never know if it's good or not, if it's going to get. And then there's always the thing is, okay, it didn't work with that audience. How many more times do you give it before you go, nah, just got to shelve it. It's just not working. I haven't made that funny for whatever reason.
Yeah, I would say definitely always shelve jokes as well. Never forget about them for good, because there's been some that I've gone back to after years and gone, oh yeah, maybe, you know, I've got a new idea about this and it's worked.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think it's Logan Murray who says there's no such thing as a bad idea, just an underdeveloped idea.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if you're going to be offensive, racist, homophobic, that's probably a bad idea.
But, yeah.
You know, anything apart from that is just an underdeveloped idea, and there's always something funny there, I think.
Yeah. This is an off the ball kind of question. So how do you find it being a, I don't know if it's gay, queer, I don't know how you'd prefer to be referenced as.
Gay is fine, yeah.
Gay in this kind of industry, and what it's like being around all of being, because it's not, I don't know if the industry's, I don't even know what I'm trying to say. I'm just trying to work out what people's experiences are, I guess, more than anything.
I mean, there's plenty of queer nights.
Yeah.
And queer, you know, there's the Queer Comedy Club, which I'm part of the furniture generally sometimes. but yeah, I do that a fair bit. Obviously, in the early days, there was GMB as a quite a queer vibe, but also they used to run queer nights. I don't know if they still do.
Yeah.
There's plenty out there, but also, I like gigging outside of London as well.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, proper audiences, and when I say proper, I'm talking like proper blokes as well. What I'm trying to say is I play well to homophobic audiences, surprisingly. I love it. Because I've always got that in my back, because they don't expect, you know, that's my whole sort of vibe, I guess, that no one expects me to be gay, but yeah. And then when you, because they, you know, Gary or Steve or whoever, you know, bald head in the front row, goes to watch Millwall at the weekends, if he's like, you know, he thinks, oh, you're one of me sort of thing, and then I say, oh, fuck men, it's a bit of a shocker. I mean, I had one a while back where I was introduced as Matty Boy, the MC, and maybe just forgot my surname. I don't know. And this guy who was actually called Steve in the front row was like, what, Batty Boy? You're going to find out a lot. And, you know, by the end of the, and that's one where I just abandoned my set, and I was just, you know, chatting to Steve and chatting up Steve. yeah, because that puts them on the back foot. They hate it. Well, they do like it secretly as well.
Yeah.
And then someone else piped up, and then me, Steve, and that other person were organising a threesome, and it just, you know, that never, you know, the threesome never materialised, but, you know, it was a fun gig. So
I bet. I think it's when you get something that you don't expect, and you always know that if somebody's brave enough to shout something out from the audience as well, that they want to be kind, they want some involvement in there.
Yeah,
they want to be part of it. So, yeah, so long as they're the sort of person that takes it in the chest that it's intended, I think it's always good fun.
Yeah, I think that's something that I know that I need to work on with regards to crowd work. I'm not very good at materializing stuff, being like, oh, so you know, what do you do? Blah blah blah. Let's make a joke out of this. But when it comes to someone coming at me, I can roll with the punches. So I just need to get better at, you know, creating that situation rather than just reacting to it.
Yeah, no, it's all good fun. I think we can all. I think interactions with the audiences are a really good skill to have.
Yeah,
in comedy, and the ability to dip in and out of sets, as I said before, is priceless. Because you bring somebody else along on the journey, and your ultimate role is to entertain people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of dipping in and out came with experience for me, because you know, like I say, I did the same set for ages, and I was like, if anything happens, then I won't know what to do. You know, I'm just used to going up there saying what I want to say, and then getting off the stage.
Yeah,
you know. But now I absolutely love reacting to stuff in the audience and stuff.
So with the work in progress show, was that something you put on just for yourself, or was that a kind of like a comedy night with you as the main headline type thing?
No, that was something I put on myself. So yeah, if you speak to the Queer Comedy Club, Jeremy, David and Kate, they will say, right, okay, you know, 6:30 on a night, come in, do an hour, and then they'll do their show afterwards. Which actually worked out quite well for me, because I struggled to get anyone in. And I've done it before for other people's work in progress shows at the Queer Comedy Club, where they've gone, right, you can if you're doing the show in the evening, do you want to come along to a work? Do you want to get there a bit early? Come along to a work in progress show. I've been like, yeah, sure. And then, thankfully, some other people did it for me, so I had a audience to play to.
Oh, good. Cool. So the show's starting to take some shape now, then.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's. I feel like I should be more stressed about it. but I'm not. I have my moments of being like, ah, shit. I've made a good dent in it. Cool. And I'm doing, I've got a few sort of training things lined up. I'm working with Rob Holden.
Okay.
Who I've worked with before, so that'll be like a Zoom thing where we'll run through things, pick things apart, and he'll make suggestions and that sort of thing. So I'm confident. Yeah, I'm quietly confident and excited, but I know that when it comes to halfway through April, I don't know, it might be halfway through April when this comes out, I don't know, but I might be terrified. I will be. I take out the might. I definitely will be terrified by that.
You still got time at the moment.
Yeah.
So exactly. what's the dates and where is it taking place? I'm still Brighton Fringe, but
now you're asking me questions that I. so it's on the the first weekend of Brighton. First weekend of May.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact timings, but it's evening timings. I think it's like 6:45 or something like that. The second weekend I've got off, and then the third and fourth weekend, both Saturday and Sunday, evening timings. I'll be putting that up on my Instagram, which is matt.lowes. So, yeah, I don't have them right in front of me now. So
I'll grab them off you after this, and I'll put them put the stuff into the note section of the podcast so people can listen to this and then immediately find a link to get to you.
Okay,
hopefully
that.
Hopefully come along, buy some tickets, or chuck your money in the bucket at the end. However, you're doing the thing.
Yeah, it'll be chuck money in the bucket in the end. To be honest, yeah, pay what you think it was worth, and then that's when I'm sitting there with an empty bucket afterwards. Going, oh, okay, they paid what they thought it was worth.
they're always quite interesting to me. Is that I always wonder if people are more generous on a bucket thing than they would be if they were paying fiver for a ticket.
I don't know, because some people might just do a couple of quid, some people might do a tenner, some, you know, maybe it balances out and it's the same in the end. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you get those small groups of people that have a little bit of one-upmanship on each other as well. Oh, you only put a fiver in, I'll put 70. And the next I'm like, I'll put 8 in. I'll have this tenner. Okay, this is good.
I enjoy it when people identify the person in the audience with a good job.
Yeah,
it's like you work in banking. You can at least put £20 in. Thank you very much. Yeah,
and buy the rest of the room a drink at the end as well.
Exactly.
So, so how many gigs have you done now? Ballpark. You're beyond the counting stage, obviously.
I think it's about 430, something like that.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, I think last year was the first year of really taking it seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, in 2022, I just had a breakup. I was dealing with a lot, and I developed a bit of a cocaine addiction during 2022.
Okay.
You know, you don't think it is an addiction or a problem at the time.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're, I would be bad after, like, I'd had a couple of drinks. So I'd go to a gig, maybe have a couple of beers or whatever, and then come home and go, oh, do you know what I really fancy? Yeah, I really fancy just not sleeping tonight. yeah, I know. But yeah, I'm absolutely fine. I've been over a year clean now. So of any, not alcohol, but yeah, any sort of illegal substances.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, when I look back, I did my heat of the Leicester Square New Comedian of the Year in 2022, I'd done that without sleeping the night before.
Right, okay.
And that's when you go, yeah, you wasn't taking that very seriously, were you?
Yeah.
You know, so when I go, going back to what we said before about this new breed coming into the comedy scene and really sort of taking it seriously and smash, and I wasn't. And I go, yeah, actually, yeah, that's fair enough, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So, yeah, obviously in 2023, to really sort of really gear things up, was doing a lot of gigs. Like I say, got to two competition finals, which I'm happy with, which is progress.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm just sort of carrying that on, but I've slowed down on the gigs.
Mm-hmm.
So my New Year's resolution was 3 gigs a week maximum.
Okay.
I mean, there was times last year when I was just going crazy for gigs. So I've basically gone from being addicted to cocaine to being addicted to gigging.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, don't be addicted to anything.
Yeah.
So for last year, I mean, there was times when I would do like 11 gigs in a row. And I never double up, but I would get ill. Yeah. I would like get a cold after that because I'll be run down. I'd be like, oh, this was not worth it at all. You know, and I know that there's some people who would do that and double up and stuff like that, or the, you know, young guns and things like that. I'm like, no, I'm getting too old for this. I have, you know, not saying they don't, but I have a day job as well. I need to, you know, need to chill out. So 3 a week is enough to stop me from being rusty on stage, but also give me the time to do some writing and preparation for the show. And maybe try and have a life as well. Can you imagine that? Like having a life outside of comedy. People are listening to open mic comedy, comedians are listening to this going, no, that's not possible. No, you can't do that. I mean, I'm failing at the moment, I don't, but you know.
It is an interesting thing where you don't realise how all consuming it can get.
Yeah,
it's a very it does become a kind of an addiction in a roundabout kind of way, I guess, because you're constantly thinking about what your jokes are, how you can change them, what you can do with them, and then you start finding yourself going to comedy shows and stuff like that just to watch, and you start losing sight of like the home balance as well. Because if you've got a partner that's not into comedy at all or things like that, then it becomes it can be a challenge.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It can be difficult. But like you say, it's an addiction because you're chasing the high, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, when you have those laughs and those good nights, you're like, yeah, that made me feel good. Let's go back to doing that again. You know,
yeah.
Try and keep that.
100%.
I always say it's like, it's death or glory, isn't it? It's, you know, it either goes horribly wrong, which feels awful, or it goes brilliantly. And it's those times that when it goes brilliantly, that's why we keep doing it.
Yeah.
That feeling.
I tend never to celebrate when I come off the stage. My point is, when I know it's gone well, you kind of see all the tension drain out of my body.
Right.
And it's like mass amount of relief that, thank Christ, that went well. And I know it went well. And I see the people that may have come to see me and they're like thumbs up or smiling. You're like, thank you. Thank you so much. And it's just like, it's just this weight has just gone. And I'm in space now and it's great. It's fantastic. I've never been one for drugs or anything. I've never really done anything. But the time that you come off that stage, especially, I liken like the showcase as the gateway drug.
Right, yes.
If the showcase goes really well, you are constantly chasing that high again.
Yeah.
And I think I've spoken to a few people in here, and I don't know if it's possible to get that high again. Because it was the first time. I think, you know, that feeling of, you know how hard it was to get up on stage to do that and to basically make people laugh with stuff you've created that you never knew that could make people laugh. And then you're like, that's amazing. I want that again. How do I get that again? How do I get it again? And then you constantly chase it and it's like, you can get close, but I don't know if you can get that again. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that after my showcase, the feeling was just relief that I'd done it. It's just, I was like, right, okay. I mean, I was pacing up and down outside the Bill Murray, you know, just on those, going, oh, God, am I going to do this? Can I run? What, you know, like... Can I escape? Can I emigrate to somewhere else where nobody knows me? But obviously, you know, it's putting yourself out of your comfort zone, and now that's, you know, we're here. If I hadn't have done that, I wouldn't be talking to you on this podcast, on the phone, on the stand. You know, that's how far we've come.
I don't know if you... This is a question that's always intrigued me. Have you we can take this out if you don't want to answer it. But have you ever performed whilst high?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, not often. No. I think I did it once or twice. But yeah, it was. I remember going to the station. On the way to a gig, whilst being high.
Yeah.
And there was police there, and they were like with sniffer dogs and stuff like that. And I was terrified. I didn't get caught. I was fine. But yeah. Yeah, I did. But I mean, one of my very early gigs, there was a gig called Birdies the Savoy Top. On like a Friday night, and I had about 10 friends there, and I wasn't high or anything like that, but because I had so many friends, they put me on last like close to the last, just before the headliner, because obviously they didn't want me to perform and then my friends just to bugger off. They wanted the audience to stay there. And I thought I was just on a night out with my friends for quite a bit, but I completely forgot that I was going to be performing. And I was absolutely shit-faced. Thankfully, it was a time when I was doing the same set over and over again.
Yeah.
So you just go into robot mode and you can just do it, you know. Yeah. But, yeah, I was in a state. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, not performing really, really high, but, yeah, a little bit I've done.
Yeah.
Couple of times before, yeah.
Okay. I was just intrigued me to see what the... It almost sounds like what the difference would be in terms of doing it that way and doing it sober as such. I guess it's a bit similar to... I don't know if it would be similar as in if you were drinking a lot. Because I've seen people that have been drunk on stage and you're kind of like, oh, this could have been so good. But the fact that you're drunk is now the biggest distraction of everything.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've seen people up there drunk who go, yeah, I'm so drunk I've forgotten my I've forgot my set. I'm like, yeah, that's a bit bad, but yeah.
Okay, we'll do a swift U-turn on this then. So if you were to become super, super famous, Brighton goes amazingly well, talent agent spots you and goes, I want that guy. And the BBC come along and said, I want to put you on stage at Live at the Apollo. Here's your 20-minute slot. Yeah. What would you pick as your walk-on music?
I would go with a band called Real Big Fish.
Okay, it's a new one to me.
I'm a very obscure person, Mark. I'm not going to throw in references that anyone knows. And I got a song called Beer.
Okay.
And it's very sort of uplifting and that sort of thing. You know, if I do, what is it, Top and Bottom? Have you done Top and Bottom comedy?
No, I haven't.
In Shoreditch before? That's a really good one. But they sort of let you choose your walk-on music.
Oh, okay.
So I always go for Real Big Fish Beer. So I've got to stick with it. It's like, yeah. It's the brands now. I mean, I say it's the brand. It's the only night where I have walk-on music, so it's hardly a brand. But, you know, once I get to the Live at the Apollo, then I say once, it's not going to happen. But you know, in this hypothetical situation that we're talking about, Mark, yeah, that's the one that I'll go for.
Okay. That's interesting, actually. So Top and Bottom, so that's open mic. Level
that is, yeah, it's the open mic one, yeah.
That's the only one I've ever known of that would give somebody an introduction music,
yeah. You can choose your own, so and yeah, it's a lovely night, it's a non bringer.
Okay,
and I'm just gonna make it harder for me to book it now because I've told I told everyone how great it is, yeah. Damn it. But you know, it's yeah, but you know, I don't do bringers anymore. I made the decision about a year ago.
Yeah,
that's me done with bringers. Not that I've progressed. Like, oh, when I tell people I don't do bringers, they're like, oh right, okay, too good for bringers. No, I'm not. I just I've done my time, I think, you know.
Yeah.
I think I did about, it's when someone said to me, a friend of mine, he's another comedian, Louis Christie, said to me, oh, so you've done like 200 gigs and all of them have been bringers. So you've been to 400, and I was like, not all of them, but yeah, a large percent. Yeah. It's like, you've been to a lot of gigs to be, you know, so
yeah,
it's kind of, and some of them, you know, I like to try every night that I can as well. Mm-hmm. Obviously, some of them are going to be very quiet nights if they're non-bringers, and you know, but you know, I always try them out.
Yeah,
try them out first.
Yeah, the bringers is the necessary evil. I think every comedian understands that bringers are necessary, especially at the starting point.
Yeah,
as much as they don't want to have to bring people, then you've got the option, yeah, I can perform in front of nobody or I can perform in front of a crowd.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You just roll with the punches. But like every comedian I speak to says, yeah, necessary evil. We'd like to get rid of the idea, but especially in a city like London, where there is a massive amount of open mic nights that go on every single night.
Yeah.
So there can't be an audience for everyone. It can't exist because there's too many of them.
Yeah, exactly.
We need these nights to be able to practice and play and have a laugh and learn and do whatever else. But yeah, I think it's a necessary evil that we'd love to get rid of. But oh well.
Yeah,
we have to
definitely. I mean, starting out, you're not gonna be able to gauge an audience reaction if there's like four people in the or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think it works.
I agree.
I'm being like, I don't do them, but you know, I don't do them. Everyone else, no. I think, yeah, to start off with, until you're really sort of comfortable, then yeah, bringers is the way.
Yeah, I think as well that if promoters see that you've brought people in the past and they're the ones that are starting to give you sort of longer 7, 10 minute, even 15 minute sets or whatever, then they'd rather have you than not have you and a bringer.
Yeah.
I think that's a good positive thing. Because it also shows progress as well. That you're trusted enough that they think you're going to be entertaining enough to entertain everybody else without having to drag that one friend along that doesn't want to come along again. Yes. I have to be very picky and choosy about which ones I go for.
Yeah.
You get people, you get your friends go, oh, are you performing? Yeah, next week. Oh, come. No, don't come. It's not a bringer. Come to the one the following week, please. Please, don't come this week. I want you there, but no. If you're going to come to both of them, then great. But no, don't come to this one.
I mean, do your friends comply with that or do they?
Most of the time. I've got, my problem is I travel in from outside London. Mm. So it's a big ask to have with people saying, do you want to pay money on a train and for drinks and for food? Because the time you're leaving outside of London is between 5 and 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And it's a lot to ask for them to get a friend along to come and watch you do 5 minutes and then watch 10, 12 other people do their 5 minutes. So you have no idea who they are.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. When I first started, I wasn't in London. I was in Sussex.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I used to, I mean, I didn't used to get the train. I used to drive. And, yeah, when you're doing like TNT or something like that, and it's finishing at 10, 11 o'clock, and you're driving from North London to Sussex and getting home at 1 o'clock in the morning, then getting up for work, it's tough.
it's hard.
So, yeah. You probably had nights like that getting back up to Stevenage,
I'm quite fortunate in terms of the trains, but it's still not a 10 minute taxi ride or a 10 minute tube ride home, you know. It's from the moment if I leave a gig, you know, it's a minimum of an hour before I'm getting home, minimum. Yeah. And that's if I catch the right tube and I don't have to wait and I catch the right train, everything goes in perfect harmony. But in reality, it's an hour and a half. So if I finish a gig at like I'm doing Too Far Comedy at half past, it'll finish about 9:30 on a Monday. I still only have to get one train.
Right.
But that's still going to take me an hour and a half to get home.
Yeah. Which at 9:30 is, that's an early finish for a night, isn't it? So I'm sure a lot of them don't, you know, other ones won't finish at that time. So
yeah, even just like a finish, even if you've got a finish at 10 o'clock and you've got a 15-minute walk to the next train station or tube station.
Yeah.
God, please don't. But, you know, I think it's all part of the course. You just have to be, with bringers, you have to be mindful of your friends. And
yeah. And then I take it, of course, you have to come back to London. If you bring it for another, if another comedian's bring it for you,
yeah,
then you have to come back to London to bring it for them as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, I tend to, I've got a few friends in London that will come along and the comedians that will do the bringer for me. But yeah. I always have to say, look, I don't guarantee I can repay this ever.
Right.
I'll be open and honest, is that, you know, when you've got a family life at home, and if I'm traveling into London to do my own thing, I can't take another day out or another night out to then come and then sit with you, which I'd love to do.
Yeah.
But it's just not possible with life all the time. So I always go with that caveat with friends, is that if you need a bring and return, don't be my bringer. Yeah. If you want to come along for a laugh and see other people you know, please come along. I'd be grateful to have you. But I cannot guarantee I will repay this favour.
No, that's fair enough.
So I'm always upfront and honest. But yeah, you can come on a podcast and promote your stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll try and give back in other ways. that's actually an interesting kind of thing with the bringers and the starting point of somebody who's just got into comedy is you've done your 400 plus gigs. Mm. You've been in this now for coming up to 5 years, take away COVID, 4 years. And is there any tips you'd give, or one single tip you would give to somebody, even if it seems something small, something that you think will be fundamental that makes a difference to how they would go forward?
Yeah, I think going back to what we were saying earlier, I think it doesn't have to be perfect. Hmm. You know, people worry about sort of mannerisms by saying or, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, when you're trying to think of something to say. I mean, obviously if you're doing that too much, it shows that you're not confident or whatever, but it also can show a bit of the human side,
yeah.
You know, rather than very robotic, this is how I want to present it, this is my next joke, blah, blah, blah. You know, I think people, it makes people, the audience, feel like you're in the room.
Yeah.
You know, so people try and eradicate it by probably, you know, on public speaking courses and things like that, they've been told, you know, don't do any mannerisms or anything like that. I think in comedy it makes you feel more human, to be honest.
Yes,
so,
completely. I think that understand what your hands are doing is always something that I, until you watch yourself back, you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And understanding what you're doing and the kind of body language you're giving off, I think is quite crucial to understand and look at. And it's something that people probably don't actually pay that much attention to. Because I did a workshop where we were talking about how to take, it sounds so stupid, how to take the mic out of a stand.
Mm.
And it was me that asked the question. It's like, how do you do it so it's seamless? Because I see it every time, and I 100% still do it to this day, and it winds me up every time I do it. Because as I'm doing it, I'm thinking, what the hell are you doing? Is that you see some people where they'll walk on stage, they'll grab the mic, they'll move the mic stand, but it doesn't look like they've done anything. Because what they've done is they've managed to have eye contact with the audience the whole time.
Yeah.
Whereas you, as a newbie, and you come on stage, you look at the mic, you look where you're grabbing the mic, you pull it out of the stand, and then naturally you then look down to see where the lead is, and you're grabbing the stand, and all of this, you've taken your eyes off the audience. Yeah. You've broken that immediate connection you had. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think a big thing as well is putting the mic back into the mic stand.
Yeah.
I think that makes you look like after you've finished, if you bring the mic stand back, it sounds so obvious, then put it back in.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds so obvious, but it makes you look like you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right. Because I see so many people that are like, and thank you very much, and then look for the mic stand,
yeah,
and then or just stand there with a microphone ready to hand it back to the MC as if to say, help, you know,
yeah.
I'm done now, come and save yeah. me. So it's just one of those things that, you know, makes you look like, yeah, you know what you're doing, which I guess is what we're all trying to do, right?
Yeah.
Make it look like we know what we're doing.
It's the fake it till you make it kind of thing, isn't it?
Exactly.
And it's interesting, actually, because I used to try to do something with the mic stand at the end. Was that I used to try to bring it in whilst I'm finishing off.
Yeah.
Because it then kind of signals to the audience, this is coming to an end.
Yeah.
Rather than, I've told my last joke, thank you very much.
Yeah.
You know, that's so it. You kind of give the audience that ability to go, and now you can laugh.
Yeah.
And cheer and whatever. And it's interesting how all of these things around something so simple, you speak to a lot of people, oh, the mic technique and all that makes no difference. I swear it does. If you look like you know what you're doing, you give off confidence to the audience, and the audience are like, I don't feel like I'm watching an amateur.
Yeah, especially like you say, initially when you take it out of the stand, there's so many people that get tangled up, and it's sometimes it does, and it's just like how you can deal with that.
Yeah,
you know, yeah, that's fine. I know what I'm doing. That's all right.
You have to make a joke of it. You have to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. rather than, oh my god, my set's gone wrong already. You know.
Yeah.
Be in the room, chill out. Doesn't have to be perfect.
Yeah.
Fine, you know.
I like that. Doesn't have to be perfect. Yeah. That's quite a nice name for a show.
that is. Doesn't have to be perfect. Yeah. A non-perfect comedy show. Yeah, I like that.
See, this is when I think this is something that comedians do a lot, is when they're talking about stuff and things just crop into their head and it's just like, oh yeah. And your brain kind of goes off into a distance. You're like, no, come back. We're doing something. But like, I'll try and say thank you very much for your time today. It has been an absolute pleasure having you on here.
It's been a lot of fun.
But as always, as you've listened to every episode, as you say, you know what's coming next. I have the Comedian's Challenge. So for any new listeners, I have this book that's called The Little Book of Shit Jokes by Sid Finch. And I'm challenging every single comedian that comes onto this podcast to pick a joke from the book to do on stage, whether they want to do it in isolation or part of their set, however they wish. They get to pick their own joke, film it, and tag us on Instagram and all of that jazz. But they only get to pick it by page number. So they don't know what's going to come out, and I don't know what's going to come out. So you're up for this?
What I would say, Mark, is have you done this challenge before?
By the time this goes out, the challenge will have been completed by myself.
Yes. Right, good. Someone else has challenged you to it.
Yes,
yes. Good on them, because that's what I was going to do, and I got there too late. So
I'll just give a bit of backstory. There's a particular open mic night I've been trying to get onto since I started,
yeah.
And when I got to this point, I'd never got onto this night, and when I got to the point of doing this section of the podcast, the guy said, can I pick two jokes? And I was like, okay, why? And he said, well, I'll do one and I want you to do one at a date of your choosing on one of my nights. And I'm just like, done, deal.
Brilliant.
Yeah. My joke is terrible.
I'm looking forward to that episode. Yeah.
That's coming out soon. So if you want to give it a go a number between 5 and 95.
Has 21 been taken?
Ooh. No, it hasn't.
Okay, I'd have 21, please.
21. You actually have two jokes on this page. So would you like joke number one or joke number two?
I'm going to go for joke number two, please.
The joke I'd like you to tell on stage as part of a set is as follows. Shitting now.
Oh, God, that's not a good reaction, Mark.
Two drums and a cymbal fall off a cliff. Ba-dum-tish.
Okay, we can work with that. Well, I'm going to have to. I have no other option, so yeah.
Yeah. Probably not put it in the Brighton show, but, you know.
No, if that's what you're expecting, you're going to be disappointed, I'm afraid. That's not going to happen. But, yeah, I could do it at a new material night. This Good. Is my new material.
Kindly curated by somebody called Sid Finch, who I have no idea who they are.
Yeah, well, I bet, yeah. I mean, they'll be very pleased. Hopefully they'll listen to this podcast if they're, you know.
Hopefully so.
Yeah,
but if anybody wants to have a look at any of the previous efforts, if you go onto our Instagram page, under the reels section or the tag section, there's a few of them under there, and some of them are quite entertaining. How people have incorporated a silly joke into their set, so
yeah,
that's pretty cool. So yeah, I think that's roundup. We're done. So thank you for coming along.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
And one last thing, your social media links.
Yeah, I'm just really on Instagram, which is matt.lowes, matt.lowes.
Okay. And I'll grab the details of Matt's show in Brighton after this, and I'll get them in the description. So this podcast will be out before then. So please, if you're in the area or if you're not and you want to travel, get along there, go and see what the show's about. And I'm sure you'd like a little review somewhere. Nice,
yeah, please.
5-star review.
Yes. A good review. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. And in the meantime, if you listen to this on any podcast platform, a little 5-star review would be lovely. Don't worry about 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4. You can find us on Instagram at Open Mic Comedy Pod, and all the W's, openmiccomedypod.com. If there's anybody you think would benefit from listening to any of this, please share it with them. Let them know this exists. The more people that listen, the more comedians want to come on, the more comedians want to tell the stories. And if you are a comedian and you want to appear, please drop me a DM on Instagram and we'll see what we can get sorted out. So until next time, I shall speak to you all soon.